Our next guest on Sunday Extra was last on the show in 2024, speaking about a piece she co-wrote in The Diplomat on Papua New Guinea and the way it was dealing with challenges of China's expanding role in the Pacific. Today, we welcome back Patricia O'Brien to talk about her latest book, Errol Flynn, The True Story of Australia's Hollywood Icon. Now, that might sound like a complete change of subject, but as we'll discover, in some ways it's not really, because as Patricia recounts, the very many aspects of Errol Flynn's conduct that would euphemistically be described as problematic these days included stints as part of Australia's brutal colonial presence in New Guinea. Patricia O'Brien is Adjunct Professor in Asian Studies at Georgetown University and also Honorary Associate Professor in the ANU's Department of Pacific Affairs. And as she rightly observes, Errol Flynn's incredible life elicits competing emotions that run the full gamut from ardent admiration and curiosity to disgust, but that for all that, he remains Australia's greatest Hollywood icon. Patricia O'Brien, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thank you, Julian, and I'm so glad to be here.
There have been many accounts of the life of Errol Flynn written over the years, but yours is billed as the first complete account of Errol Flynn's life. Why is that?
Well, I think what I have done and the way that I've been able to look at his life is because of some particular sources that I've looked at, particularly family letters that are in the National Library of Australia, which give a whole different aspect of his personal life, his intimate life. And the pieces of the puzzle come together much more because of these sources. I also used sources that are in the United States, which give the background, the interviews for his very famous autobiography, My Wicked, Wicked Ways. So it's sort of like the backstory of that. So with those two things put together and all the other information out there, I think I was able to put together a picture of him, his life, how consequential and controversial he was in new ways.
Yes, the backstory to the writing of My Wicked, Wicked Ways, which if nothing else was well titled, is a hell of a story in itself. Tell us about the letters and those sources, though. Patricia, what insights did you gain into Errol Flynn from those sources?
Yeah, well, those sources were really interesting because they are basically letters that were written between Errol, his mother, Mirelle Flynn, and his father, Theodore Flynn, who was quite well known because he was a famous professor of biology. And also there are some letters from his sister as well. So you get to see into the interior world of the Flynn family for the first time and find out facts about their life, which had been hidden, secrets, which actually had a huge impact on who Errol became.
Spoiler alert, could you tell us some of those?
Yes, well, one thing which hasn't really been talked about before is that when Errol was a young boy, about 11 or something like that, his parents split up. His father was having a lot of affairs. They split up when they went to London, and Errol's mother lived for 7 years with another man in France with Errol's younger sister. And this was the time when Errol was basically marooned in boarding schools in England. His father went back to Hobart to do his professor work at the University of Tasmania, and his mother was living with this man in France. And so Errol had this experience in his formative years of being really abandoned by his family, and it had a really big impact on him. The other thing is that there was a history of family violence. That was something which I don't think has really come out before. Errol Flynn's father has always been portrayed in a very positive light, particularly by his son. But there are letters in that collection which reveal some pretty gut-wrenching details about the life of the Flynn family.
Yes, there are gut-wrenching details aplenty amongst the lives of the parents and throughout Errol's life. You describe your book, Patricia, as digging beneath the American myth of Errol Flynn to uncover the Australian man and to trace the odyssey from his birth in Hobart to his burial in Hollywood. It is, by any measure, an utterly extraordinary life. For those who aren't that familiar, I wonder if you could just give us the overview of that life and how it went from not only Hobart to Hollywood, but also to Papua New Guinea and Jamaica.
As you said, Errol was born in Hobart in 1909. He spent a number of very happy years in Hobart, and then things turned for him when his father's career took the family out of Tasmania, and they went to London when his father got a fellowship, and that started these years of real sadness for Errol when his parents split up. Then he was taken out of school and went back to Hobart with his father, and he had more sort of terrible years at school. He never really graduated. And then he was moved out of Tasmania to Sydney, and he had his final stint at school at the Shaw School in North Sydney. He didn't finish school. He left. This was while his father was overseas. He knew his father would be very upset that he'd left school. Gold had just been discovered in New Guinea. So Errol thought he could get on a boat and go up to New Guinea and make his fortune, as did a whole lot of other Australian men around the same age and time. So he went up to New Guinea. He was there for 6 years, coming and going from Sydney. And then in 1932, on one of his trips to Sydney, he was discovered on Bondi Beach by the Australian filmmakers Charles and Elsa Chauvel, and he was cast as Fletcher Christian in their film In the Wake of the Bounty. He'd come out of New Guinea operating a plantation at the time. He engaged in a bit of gold seeking. He was also labour recruiting. And then he just gets this moment in front of the cameras, and he's actually really good. He's got this very fit, very aesthetically pleasing presence, and he also had a beautiful speaking voice. Now, this is at the time when sound was a very new thing. So that's one of the reasons why the Chauvels picked this complete unknown with no acting experience. So he gets cast there, he goes back to New Guinea, does some more labour recruiting, and then he leaves New Guinea and he goes to England in 1933. And in 1934, he has a year of acting in various theatres, and Warner Brothers have a talent spotting outfit in London. And Errol gets cast in a film, and everyone's like, wow, this person has really got it. And they sign him up. And in 1934, he comes across the Atlantic to Hollywood. And in 1935, he gets cast in a leading role in a film called Captain Blood. And he is really good in it, and he becomes a sensation. So he's basically gone from being a labour recruiter in New Guinea in 1933 to being a Hollywood star within the span of 2 years.
Yeah, it's utterly amazing. And really, he then ascends to, you know, the absolute heights of Hollywood stardom. And in a way, the tale of his demise feels at this point like a classic tale of celebrity and excess, impunity and poor conduct. In other ways, though, it was much, much worse than many of the cliches of those sorts of tales. Could you tell us a little bit about the criminal trials that Errol Flynn faced while he was at the height of his stardom?
Yes. So Hollywood was kind of known as America's Sodom. This was a time of social purity campaigns and things like that. But in Hollywood, there was this culture of promiscuity amongst the actors, and Errol Flynn rapidly became the poster boy of this promiscuous masculinity. So he was known to be having relationships with all kinds of women. He also, in 1935, before he became a star, he married this very beautiful French actress who is known as a sex siren. Her name was Lily Demeter, and that was one of the reasons he was cast in his first film, was because of Lily. But Errol, even though he was married, he was very much into practicing infidelity. But the thing that got him into trouble was he wasn't the only one, but he was known to have relationships with underage girls.
Well, yeah, without putting it too bluntly, he does come across as the Jeffrey Epstein of his day.
Well, he isn't the mastermind of a vast sexual abuse network. He's part of it, and he's probably the most famous face of it. And it's something that predated him. I mean, that's something that I talk about in the book, these cases that are really shocking, which really revealed the extent of these sexual trafficking networks of young women in Hollywood. But in 1915, 42, Errol Flynn is basically prosecuted for sexual relations with a girl who was underage. And it was really supercharged by the district attorney of LA at the time, who was really trying to rein in this sexual culture. He was a bit of a standalone figure in sort of fighting against this culture. And so he thought Errol Flynn made a perfect case to really make an example of.
Yes, that didn't exactly go that well, though.
No, it didn't. It backfired because, yeah. I mean, he thought it was the most watertight case of its kind that had been brought. But the case went completely against the goals that the district attorney wanted because Errol Flynn, as you pointed out, was at the height of his fame. He was 33 and he had already a massive following amongst men and amongst women, particularly young girls and also older women. And with this trial, most of the jurors were these older women who absolutely adored Errol Flynn. And the whole story of the trial is amazing and shocking and confronting.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you describe it as a carnivalesque atmosphere. I think some of the sentences that really struck me was one of his victims who said, "He is so prominent, but he was so savage." That's a pretty hard sentence to forget.
Yeah, that was one of the turning points for me. People had written, obviously they'd written about Errol Flynn's trial before, but they'd thought, oh, you know, she looked 18, you know, all of these kind of excuses. You know, it was consensual. Everyone wanted to have sex with Errol Flynn. You know, yeah, she might have been a bit underage, that kind of thing. But when I read that account from one of his victims, I was like, okay, there's something more going on here. And it really stayed with me. Like, this was something a lot more than just a case of consensual relationships. Mm, there was something really violent going on.
And nor was it an isolated incident. And yet, you quote Errol Flynn himself saying, "I seem to have emerged from the trial," in which, of course, he was acquitted, "almost in the form of a hero."
Yes, that's what he wrote to his parents after the trial was over and he was acquitted on 3 counts of statutory rape. He wrote to his family and said he did not enjoy being on trial, but he basically realized very early on that this was incredibly beneficial for him. And the studios realized it really quickly during the trial, which was front page news, that people were going to see Errol Flynn movies. They had to extend seasons of his films. They rushed new films through. And that classic persona that had been sort of implanted in the public mind of him being this hero fighting against injustice, he was actually living that out in real life. So there was this real blending together of fact and fiction. It really burnished his reputation and he did become a hero as a result of it and much more wealthy. He got paid a lot more money.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Patricia O'Brien about her new biography of Errol Flynn, the true story of Australia's Hollywood icon. Patricia, I think it's fair to say that one of the regrettable themes of Errol Flynn's life, an unfortunate through line, if you like, is his involvement in slavery. Mm-hmm. In more than one way. Could you speak to that, please?
Yes. So he was in the colonies of New Guinea, Papua and the Mandated Territory. He engaged in the labour recruiting economy there. He ran plantations, but he also recruited labour, which meant you had to basically sell people. And the whole system was geared towards massive exploitation of the local people. So that was a form of slavery, of indenture. And then when he goes to Hollywood, the studio system at the time that was in place, the language of the time was that actors were indentured to studios. And so there was this real fight going on between actors and the Hollywood studios to get better money for the actors. Well, Errol Flynn, because he had this experience in the colonies with people being bought and sold, was actually extremely good at negotiating a very good price for himself. But in terms of the slavery, I mean, in a lot of the films that he starred in, there was a lot of roles that he played where he was a captive, where he was enslaved. Part of that was a narrative device, which meant that he had to take his shirt off. He was a sex symbol. So there was that. And then after he's very famous and after the golden age of Hollywood is destroyed after World War II, he goes to Jamaica and buys old slave plantations there and tries to recreate the world that he missed from Papua New Guinea. So he has this thread through his life of people having prices on their heads and buying and selling people. And also, of course, part of that story that's sort of below the surface is the experience of all these young women in Hollywood.
Yes, it's a relentless account of his utterly abysmal treatment of women. Errol Flynn had a pretty drastic physical and mental demise due to alcohol and narcotics addiction. How did his life end, Patricia?
His life ended in Vancouver in 1959. And he died suddenly of a heart attack in the company of his girlfriend of the time, who was also underage.
Yeah, true to form. And we haven't even got to the decades of squabbles over his estate, which then followed.
Yes, a very complicated afterlife.
Patricia O'Brien, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thank you so much, Julian. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Patricia is adjunct professor in Asian Studies at Georgetown University. Her new book is Errol Flynn, The True Story of Australia's Hollywood Icon.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.